Imagine a world where humanity festers in layers, from a toxic abyss to spires that kiss a poisoned sky. In the depths, countless souls toil in perpetual darkness. High above, a select few revel in opulence beyond comprehension. This is Necromunda, a factory world of untold billions living and dying in the shadow of industry and indifference. On this hive world, power is hoarded by the few, privilege is paid for in blood, and pain is the currency of daily life. Welcome to the underworld of the Palatine Hive, where feudal chains of loyalty and ruthless violence bind a society on the brink. In this second episode, we peel back the layers of Necromunda's brutal social hierarchy, from the gilded cruelty of the spire elites to the lawless depths of gangland in the Underhive. Prepare to meet the masters and the downtrodden, and witness how an entire planet's social order is built on power, privilege, and pain. The Hive's great spires rise miles into the toxic clouds, gleaming like cruel needles above the filth. At the pinnacle sits Lord Helmar, tyrant and patriarch, ruling for millennia with an iron fist. Far below, gang bosses and guilders scrap over the table scraps of power, while billions of workers cling to life in rusted warrens. Necromunda's hierarchy is not just a structure, it's a battlefield, an ecosystem of oppression and ambition. In this episode, we delve into each tier of that hierarchy, the Spire's noble houses and their indulgent tyranny, the Mercator guilds that monopolize every necessity of life, the clan houses whose gangs and families form the Hive's violent backbone, the sanctioned and unsanctioned gangs that fight society's proxy wars, the forces of law, enforcers and bounty hunters who preserve a delicate balance through fear, and the all-pervasive ecclesiarchy that sanctifies it all with the imperial faith. From the highest Palatine lords to the lowest sump scum, every soul on Necromunda plays a part in this grand drama of survival. So steel yourself and mind your step. One misstep in the Hive can send you plunging from privilege to pain in a heartbeat. This is Necromunda's social hierarchy unmasked, a descent into the Spire, the Hive, and the Underhive, where only the ruthless thrive. Let's begin our journey at the very top, where power wears a human face wreathed in gold and cruelty. Lords of the Spire, House Helmar, and the noble elite. At the absolute pinnacle of Necromunda's power structure sits Imperial House Helmar, the ancient ruling dynasty that has governed the planet for over 7,000 years. The Helmar line has endured through rebellions, industrial disasters, and the grinding passage of millennia, all while clenching the planet in an iron grip. The current ruler, Lord Gerontius Helmar, is the latest in this fearsome lineage, the planetary governor of Necromunda and undisputed master of Hive Primus. From his throne in the heavens, a fortified palace at the spire's summit, Lord Helmar commands absolute authority, backed by the warrant of imperial law and the blessing of the ecclesiarchy. In the eyes of Necromunda's people, Helmar is practically a force of nature, a constant presence like the toxic air they breathe. He is the author of the planet's ancient canon of rules, a set of brutal governing principles passed down from the first Helmar to ensure Necromunda's survival through perpetual strife. Life in the Spire is a world apart from the misery below. Here dwell the noble houses, dozens of aristocratic families with bloodlines as venerable and vicious as Helmar's own. These Spire nobles exist in unimaginable luxury. Within climate-controlled crystal domes and golden halls, they feast on delicacies imported from distant worlds and drink water untainted by ash or chem privileges, literally unthinkable to the masses below. Each noble house controls its own palatial territory atop the Hive. For instance, House Ulanti, one of the oldest and most decadent great houses, occupies a needle-thin tower on the spire's edge. A palace so grand, it's said, the Ulanti have transformed its levels into fantastical-themed realms for their amusement. The noble elite measure wealth not in credits alone, but in entire industries and domains. House Ulanti, to name one, leases its factory districts to lower clans and guilders, skimming a fortune from the output of others. Some noble houses even own secondary hives or moons. Ulanti's patriarch maintains a private hunting preserve on Necromunda's moon, where Xenos beasts are hunted for sport. This gives a sense of their near-limitless wealth and influence. But beneath the veneer of opulence lies cutthroat intrigue. The noble houses scheme and backstab constantly, vying for Helmar's favor and greater slices of the planet's spoils. They are ostensibly Helmar's vassals, yet any one of them might secretly harbor ambitions of supremacy. Power plays among the spire nobility can be subtle, an arranged marriage here, an assassination there, or shockingly direct. An illustrative example. For generations, the noble house Ulanti purchased its chems and stimulants from the clan house Escher via a lucrative contract. Sensing opportunity, House Orlok, a rising industrial clan, orchestrated a campaign of sabotage against Escher's supply lines, bribing underhive gangs to wreak havoc on Escher operations. The plan succeeded. Escher's performance faltered, and Ulanti transferred the contract to Orlok, enriching one house at the expense of another. In the spire, wealth is power, and loyalties last only until a better deal presents itself. All the while, Lord Helmar keeps a watchful eye. The Helmar Patriarch treats the noble houses much like a spider in the center of a web, a favored metaphor on Necromunda. He encourages competition and jealousy among them, so that none unite against him. Each noble house owes fealty, in theory, to Helmar, paying hefty tithes and gifts for the privilege of their status. Yet Helmar is not above pruning the aristocracy. Any house that grows too bold or defiant can meet a swift and ghastly end. Fallen houses litter Necromunda's history. Once proud families erased from the spire and cast down into infamy by Helmar's decree. The lucky ones are merely stripped of titles and exiled. The less fortunate become rebel lords with high bounties on their heads, hunted for sport by sanctioned killers. To cross Helmar is to invite extinction. For those nobles who toe the line, life remains a debauched dream. In these uppermost tiers of society, decadence knows no limits. Organs are replaced and youth prolonged by expensive rejuvenate treatments. Narco-stims and cocktails of chem are consumed as casually as recaf. Indeed, without illicit drugs, the ruling elite could not extend their lives or enjoy their excesses. A hypocrisy we'll revisit when we discuss the guild's narco-trade. The spire's denizens treat the lower classes as playthings and pawns. It's not unheard of for a bored noble scion to don an exotic powered suit and descend on a spirer hunt, stalking human prey in the underhive for sport. In fact, among the high houses it's a tradition. Young nobles prove their mettle by venturing into the lawless depths in small teams called spire hunter gangs, slaying underhive gangsters or mutants for trophies. If they survive, they return as celebrated adults, ready to take their place in the family. If they die, well, that's one less heir to contend with. The hunted underhivers, of course, are given no warning or mercy. To the nobles, the lives of commoners are as cheap as the ash that chokes the hive's lower levels. In summary, the spire elite of Necromunda live in splendor, drenched in blood. They are far removed from the miseries below, yet their every whim and whisper sends ripples down the hive. House Helmar and the noble houses form the apex of the feudal pyramid, commanding the loyalty of all beneath them, either by oaths or by fear. They exploit the production of the Hive City, profiting off the labor of billions, and in return maintain a tenuous order. Thanks to the Hellmaw dogma that Necromunda must be allowed to war with itself, these lords encourage the lower factions to struggle and fight, as long as it never threatens their own lofty perch. It is a delicate balance of self-interest and suppression, and bridging the gap between the lofty nobility and the countless workers are the figures we'll discuss next, the guilders, the merchant barons who oil the gears of this dystopian society. The Mercator Guilds, masters of necessary evils. Beneath the nobles but above the commons of the Hive lie the Mercator Guilds, a cartel of merchant families collectively known as the Merchant Guild of Necromunda. If the noble houses are the lords, the guilders are the landlords and brokers, controlling the vital necessities of life and commerce across the planet. Officially chartered by Lord Hellmaw himself, each major guild holds exclusive rights over a critical resource or service, enforced by law and jealously guarded. In short, the Mercator Guilds run monopolies. No water flows, no food paste is distributed, no fuel burns, and no corpse is recycled without their say-so. Over centuries, the Merchant Guild has cemented itself as the middle layer of power in Necromunda's hierarchy. They stand between the spire nobles and the clan houses, mediating trade and ensuring that even when the clans are at each other's throats, commerce continues. This role emerged out of necessity. In a world where gang wars can erupt over a handful of bullets, someone neutral had to guarantee that the lights stay on and the factories keep humming. The guilds assumed that role and prospered immensely from it. They broker deals, negotiate truces when needed, and take a hefty cut of every transaction that passes through their hands. It is often said that credits are the one true god in the mid-hive, and the guilders its priesthood. Each guild is known by its high Gothic Mercator title, though hivers commonly refer to them by plainer names. Some of the most feared and powerful guilds include Mercator Nautica, the Water Guild. This guild controls all water supply and purification, from the rationed drinking water in worker habs to the coolant in hive manufactorums. The Water Guild's markup is on it. They can turn entire districts thirsty overnight to punish disobedience. Water Guild agents, often called Water Guilders, travel with armed escorts, guarding tanker convoys and filtration plants with lethal force. In a hive where the very air is poison and water is life, their power is existential. Mercator Pyros, the Promethium Guild. The Promethium Guild monopolizes fuel promethium, coal, synth fuel, sump gas, any combustible that keeps Necromunda's furnaces lit. If a generator runs or a vehicle moves, it's because of a deal with Mercator Pyros. They extort steep prices and tolerate no theft. Gangs that siphon fuel from guild reservoirs quickly find themselves marked for death. The guild's logos, a stylized flame, is both a mark of quality and a warning of the burning retribution for crossing them. Mercator Geld, the Guild of Coin. Despite its name, this guild's concern is more than currency. The Guild of Coin functions as Necromunda's Department of Transportation and Commerce combined. They manage trade routes, freight haulers, the massive ash trains that crawl between hive clusters, and the flow of credits. Every toll road and cargo lift likely pays tribute to coin guilders. In practice, Mercator Geld ensures Hellmaw gets his cut of all the hive's business. Guild of Coin caravans heavily armed crisscross Hive City, and woe betide any gang foolish enough to raid one without official backing. Doing so would be an unsanctioned crime against Hellmaw's economy, a line even most gangs won't cross lightly. Mercator Pallidus, the Corpse Guild. Perhaps the grimmest guild of all, the Corpse Guild is tasked with handling the dead. On Necromunda, the deceased are a resource to be harvested, processed into corpse starch to feed the living, or rendered into chemical components. Mercator Pallidus agents, called Undertakers colloquially, collect cadavers from the hive's charnel houses and battlefields. They turn death into sustenance. It's said the Corpse Guild never lets a body go to waste. Hive workers literally eat the flesh of their dead in the form of Corpse Guild corpse cakes, a practice both pragmatic and grotesque. The Corpse Guild's monopoly is absolute. Even the bodies of executed criminals are sold to them by the enforcers. Naturally, this guild breeds a morbid, cult-like atmosphere, with its members wearing grave-smelling robes and iron skull masks as they go about their harvest. Mercator Sanguis. The Slaver's Guild. Slavery is officially illegal under Imperial law, but on Necromunda the line is thin. The Slaver's Guild handles the trade of bonded workers and hive debtors. Whether it's convict gangs sold as pit slaves or entire sump war tribes captured and shipped to the factories, Mercator Sanguis brokers human lives for labor. They brand slaves with guild marks and send them to toil in mines, rad zones, or even off-world. The guild exists with Helmar's blessing. It provides a steady supply of expendable workers for the most dangerous jobs, quietly labeled indentured servants, to appease Imperial authority. Other guilds? There are dozens more, each vital in their own niche. The Electro Guild, Mercator Lux, controls power grids and illumination. They can plunge a dome into darkness at will. The Iron Guild, Mercator Munda, manages the flow of ore and metals to the foundries. There's even a Chrono Guild, Mercator Horologus, that literally keeps the clocks and work shifts on schedule. In a place where natural light doesn't exist, timekeeping is serious business. From the Air Guild, Mercator Temperium, ensuring breathable, if rank, air in the upper levels, to the mysterious Guild of Oaths, Mercator Veritas, which deals in contracts and oath bonds. Virtually every aspect of Necromundan life is administered by some guild. The guilds derive their authority directly from House Helmore's charter, and they pay for that privilege handsomely. It's a symbiotic relationship. Helmar needs the guilds to keep the hives running and to mediate the clan house feuds, while the guilds need Helmar's protection and legal backing for their monopolies. In terms of social standing, guilders rank below the spire nobles, but well above the average citizen. They are often as fabulously wealthy as minor nobility, and just as flamboyant. A water guild magnate might wear a suit of refractor-fielded armor adorned with aquifer sigils, while a coin guild master may surround himself with bodyguards and servo skulls that carry ledgers and strongboxes. Their courts in the mid-hive can be as lavish as any lord's, albeit always with a practical mercantile bent. No guilder ever truly forgets the bottom line. Yet the guilders walk a razor's edge. They prosper by playing all sides, but if they are seen to favor one house too openly, they could become a target. Their charters can be revoked by Helmore in a heartbeat should they overstep or threaten the balance of power. There are whispers of guilders who grew too independent, perhaps smuggling Xenos tech or skimming from Helmore's share, and found themselves made examples of. The lucky ones get a quick execution. The unlucky might be turned into servitors, mind-wiped cyborg slaves, destined to labor forever in the dark. For the most part, though, the Merchant Guild keeps the great web of Necromunda running. They ensure that even as gangs war and houses feud, the lights stay on, the furnaces burn, the water flows, and the corpse starch rations get distributed. They take their cut, of course. A cut in blood and coin. But without them, the hive would collapse into anarchy or simple starvation. In Helmar's grand design, the guilds are both exploiters and enablers, masters of necessary evils to prop up an inherently cruel system. Now that we've seen the lofty heights of power, the lords and the guildmasters, let's descend one tier further. Below the guilds and nobles stand the massive clan houses, the great factions that make up the bulk of Necromunda's population and industry. It's time to meet the houses whose names are spoken with equal parts fear and pride in every hive dome: Goliath, Escher, Orlok, Vansar, Delac, and Cawdor. The six clan houses, industry, war, and clan loyalty. Life in Necromunda's hive city is defined by which clan house claims you. These six great houses, sometimes called clan houses or hive city houses, are sprawling factions that each control significant territory, manufactorums, and populations in Hive Primus and beyond. They are the engine of Necromunda's industry and the backbone of its society. Each has its own culture, specialty, and brutal internal hierarchy. While we'll explore each house in depth in the next episode, for now we'll sketch how they fit into the grand scheme and how they govern themselves from within. Each clan house functions like a feudal empire within the larger feudal world of Necromunda. They are vassals to Helmar, in theory, and many owe certain duties or tithes to the noble houses or guilds, but they also fiercely guard their autonomy and pursue their own agendas. They are rivals and occasionally outright enemies to one another, yet none can be allowed to utterly destroy another. The balance of power is maintained by constant push and pull rather than total war, a balance Helmar ruthlessly enforces from above. Think of the clan houses as both crime families and corporate conglomerates rolled into one, each with a stranglehold on particular trades or products. House Goliath, House Escher, House Orlok, House Vansar, House Delac, House Cawdor. These six houses make up the vast majority of Necromunda's populace. Virtually everyone in Hive City belongs, or is indentured, to one of them. The houses provide what meager protection and identity a hiver can claim. A family, a crew, a cause. In exchange, the houses demand total loyalty, and they own their people's labor and lives. Every clan house is essentially a massive conglomerate of industrial operations and gang territories. For example, a Goliath might spend his day toiling in a furnace plant and his night fighting for his gang in the sump pit fighting arenas. Both roles ultimately serve House Goliath's power. An Escher might concoct stims in a lab by morning and knife a rival in the evening, all in service to her house. Internal power structure. Each house has a leadership that emerged from its own gang legends. On Necromunda, gangs are the crucible of leadership. As official lore notes, the most successful gang fighters often become leaders of their clan's families or the house itself. In effect, might makes right within the houses. The upper tiers of each house, whether they be called a council, over tyrant, matriarch, lord, prime, or any other title, are almost always held by those who prove themselves through combat or ruthlessness in their youth. A champion who seized territory and crushed rivals in their gang days may be elevated to oversee an entire district for the house. Over decades, some rise further to sit at the right hand of the house lord. It's telling that many clan house leaders are themselves legendary former gangers. These houses don't have democratic elections or purely hereditary successions, with partial exception of Vansar or Orlok, where family lineage matters, but even there, a weak heir can be swiftly dealt with. Instead, leadership transitions often involve violent coups, trials by combat, or the occasional mysterious disappearance of a leader who's lost their edge. To maintain control, house leaders use a mix of fear, reward, and clan pride. They reward loyal gangs with better weapons or territories to plunder. They make gruesome examples of betrayal. Each house also instills a sense that no matter how bad things are, at least you have your house. The feud culture between houses reinforces this. You're expected to hate the fools in the next house over more than the boss who works you to death. Thus, Goliaths and Orlocks will happily beat each other to a pulp over a turf dispute, rather than both asking why their conditions are awful. It's classic divide and conquer, and it works. After all, the alternative to being in a house is to be outcast, and that's a fate worse than death for many. We'll touch on outcasts soon. In this feudal urban jungle, the six clan houses form an ever-shifting mosaic of alliances and vendettas, all under the cold gaze of Lord Helmar. They fight each other constantly in small-scale wars, called gang wars or shadow wars, for resources and revenge. But they all know the limits. If any house openly mustered an army to attack another's domain in force, the wrath of the Imperial House would descend swiftly. To avoid that, they fight proxy battles using their gangs as pawns, a sanctioned outlet for aggression. And so we come to the next layer of this hierarchy. The gangs themselves, the street-level power structure that keeps the whole hive teetering between chaos and order. Gangs of the Underhive, sanctioned violence and the shadow economy. Walk down any hab-block corridor in the lower hive, and you'll see the graffiti tags of a dozen gangs, neon symbols, blood marks, severed fingers nailed to walls. All tokens of turf and the fierce intent to hold it. Gangs are ubiquitous on Necromunda. The term gang itself is broad. It encompasses everything from disciplined house-sponsored warbands to half-feral packs of mutants in the sump. As the saying goes, on Necromunda, everyone is in a gang. Some just don't know it yet. The entire social order has a place for these gangs, paradoxical as that might sound. Rather than outlaw all underworld violence, House Hellmauer's doctrine actively permits, even encourages, a certain level of internecine warfare among the lower classes. It's a pressure valve and a proving ground. Controlled violence keeps the hives productive. Better the gangs spill each other's blood than revolt against their masters. Sanctioned versus unsanctioned. A crucial distinction exists in Necromunda between sanctioned conflict and true crime. The great clan houses sanction their gangs to fight over turf, settle scores, and perform tasks beneficial to the house. These sanctioned gang battles are an accepted part of life, a form of localized warfare that everyone knows and expects. If a Goliath gang and an Orlock gang shoot each other to bits over control of a chem still, well, that's clan business as usual, as long as it doesn't threaten key infrastructure or kill important guild personnel. Helmar's forces often turn a blind eye. In fact, constant gang feuding is described as a fundamental aspect of life on Necromunda. It's practically a sport, with the Hive's population morbidly entertained by news of which gang is on top this week. These house-aligned gangs serve multiple purposes. They protect their house's territories and holdings from encroachment. They secure resources, be it a water source, an archaeotech find, or a lucrative racketeering ring for their house. They also act as the informal militia and tax collectors in their turf. A gang leader might demand tribute from local merchants, or ensure locals are loyal, or at least too afraid to cheat the house. Importantly, participation in gang warfare is the primary way for ambitious young hivers to climb the social ladder of their house. Victory in the Underhive can translate into promotion in the clan hierarchy. Win enough turf wars, bring in enough loot or glory, and a ganger could become a respected house family leader or even join the house leadership in time. Thus, the gang ecosystem sustains the feudal hierarchy. It is both the recruitment pool and the testing ground for future leaders, ensuring that only the toughest, most cunning individuals rise. On the flip side, unsanctioned violence crimes that aren't blessed by a house or that threaten the wider order are treated very differently. For example, raiding a guilder caravan without a house's blessing brands one a true criminal in Hellmauer's eyes, because it's not just gang versus gang, it's attacking the economic order. Similarly, operating an independent racket without paying due to the local house invites swift retribution. These are acts against the absolute authority of the houses, and they break the unspoken rules of the great game. Such rogues become outlaws, proper fair game for enforcers and bounty hunters alike. In Necromunda's parlance, outlaw status means Palanite enforcers have marked you for arrest or execution, and any citizen is rewarded for killing or capturing you. Worse still is to be declared an outcast, someone banished entirely. No house protection, no society ties. An outcast has no rights at all and can be murdered by anyone without consequence. They're essentially already considered dead by the system. The line can be thin. Many so-called criminals in Necromunda actually still have connections to houses or guilders. Think of narco lords who sell stims to keep workers productive and nobles young, or tech riggers who run illicit workshops but funnel kickbacks to the merchant guild. These are tolerated, even valued, as integral to the system despite their outlaw veneer. They grease the wheels of productivity and keep the Underhive's shadow economy thriving. A narco lord, for instance, might officially be an outlaw, but if his drugs ensure Hellmauer's factories meet their quotas and the guilders get rich, he's likely shielded by some powerful patron. Necromunda is rife with such double-dealing, lawbreakers who prop up the law and vice versa. To paint the ecosystem, the Hive City, Mid-Hive, where most population lives, has relatively stable house zones where a single clan is dominant. Here, gang dust-ups are usually house-on-house at borders or internal power plays. Dip below into the Underhive, the lawless, collapsed, or abandoned lower levels, and it becomes a free-for-all. Underhive sectors are often beyond even the clan house's firm control, though they might claim influence. These regions breed scavenger gangs, mutants, cults, and other misfits not officially part of the big houses. They too form gangs, packs of mutants lurking in toxic sumps, tribes of scavies, deformed cannibal bandits eking out survival, renegade tech rights, constructing bizarre weapons, and more. Even out in the ash wastes, between hives, nomad brigands form gangs raiding passing convoys. All are considered beneath notice until they cause a problem for the hive. Occasionally, these outsider gangs, or outlanders, spark events. Say, a mutant warlord unites a horde threatening a hive's outskirts, at which point the houses might cooperate long enough to squash them or dispatch bounty hunters to cut off the head. It's worth noting the phenomenon of brat gangs in the upper levels. Even among the privileged youth of the High Habs, the middle class and low nobility just below the spire, the gang mentality seeps in. Thrill-seeking young nobles form brat gangs, acting out their own violent fantasies on slummers or as proto-spirers. They're typically armed with expensive toys and a sense of invulnerability. While not a major power factor, they exemplify how gang culture permeates every social stratum. From the gutter to the glimmering heights, violence and clannish loyalty are second nature on Necromunda. The gang as family. For many hivers, their gang is more immediate and tangible than their house affiliation. A house might be millions strong. A gang is a tight unit of a dozen, on average, with whom one fights, bleeds, and possibly dies. Gangs impose their own initiation rites and codes. Commonly, new recruits must prove themselves through shows of bravery or brutality, perhaps fighting other aspirants or taking a trophy from a fallen foe. A macabre tradition across many gangs is trophy-taking, called scragging in Underhive slang, where a recruit might slice off an enemy's finger or ear as proof of kill. Indeed, it's a point of pride among veteran gangers to wave a hand missing no fingers, showing they've never failed or been forced to atone, since a severed finger is also a penalty for failure in some clans. Such customs reinforce that gang life is brutal and only respects success. Gangers earn nicknames, scars, and status through their exploits, and those who falter are maimed or cast out. This constant undercurrent of gang warfare serves Hellmauer's aims. It keeps the population scared and divided, ensures the strong leadership rises, and provides a violent outlet that doesn't challenge the overall power structure. However, it's a fine line. If a gang war gets too big, say open war between house armies rather than skirmishes, it risks true anarchy, something the Imperium will not tolerate. Thus, steps in the final piece of the hierarchy, the enforcers and their ilk, to keep the bloodshed within acceptable bounds. The Iron Fist, enforcers, bounty hunters, and the machinery of control. When gang warfare or uprisings threaten to cross the line from murderous competition into all-out rebellion, it is the enforcers who answer the call. The Palanite enforcers of Necromunda are the local law in the Hive. Though calling them police is perhaps generous, they are more akin to an occupying army, the mailed fist of House Hellmauer, poised to smash any who dare disturb the Emperor's peace or Hellmauer's order. Clad in heavy carapace armor embossed with the Palanite Star, armed with bolt guns, combat shotguns, and power mauls, enforcers are a far cry from the beleaguered beat cops of a planetary city. They are judge, jury, and executioner rolled into one, empowered to deliver instant punishment, usually lethal, to lawbreakers. Origins and role. According to Hive legend, the enforcers trace their lineage back to the time of Necromunda's founding under the Hellmauer dynasty. The first enforcer marshal was said to be the bodyguard of Martek Hellmauer, the progenitor of the line. After Martek's death, this guardian formed the original Palanite Watch to enforce Hellmauer law. True or not, it underscores that the enforcer's primary loyalty is to the Imperial House and Lord Hellmauer himself. They are not there to protect or serve the common populace, except insofar as keeping them productive and obedient. Enforcers operate out of fortified precincts and courthouses in the Hive, bastions of authority amid the sprawl. They rarely mingle with citizens. In fact, enforcer recruits are often drawn from other hives or off-world to prevent local sympathies. They are literally outsiders imposed on the populace to keep them in line. Organization. The Palanite enforcers function as a strict military hierarchy, quite unlike the gangs they suppress. At the top, the Lord Marshal and Provost Marshals answer directly to Lord Hellmauer's court, coordinating law enforcement across the whole planet, or each hive. Each hive city has a provost marshal commanding its enforcer legions. Under them, precinct captains control sectors of the hive, each based in a precinct fortress, heavily armed barracks that are essentially mini-fortresses in the mid-hive. These captains send out patrols of enforcers, typically squads of about half a dozen heavily armed officers led by a sergeant. Some squads specialize in crowd control, others in breach and clear tactics, or even handling cyber mastiffs, mechanical attack dogs, to hunt fugitives. The enforcers even have elite subdivisions, subjugators clad in heavier riot armor for cracking the toughest gang strongholds, or scrutinators and proctors who investigate high crimes and ensure even the enforcer ranks remain loyal and uncorrupted. Enforcer training is brutal. Recruits are often volunteers taken, sometimes by force, from hive youth who exhibit strength and initiative traits that, left unchecked, might have made them gang leaders or rebels. These youths are effectively broken and remade in a rigorous academy, stripped of their past identities and drilled to obey the Imperial House above all. The training either forges them into zealous hardline officers or destroys them. The weak don't survive it. Those who do emerge are given new names, a rank, and posted to precincts far from their original home. This ensures that when an enforcer swings a shock maul into a miner's skull, he feels no familial pity. To him, it's just another unruly statistic. Justice, Necromunda style. The enforcers enforce Hellmauer's law, which is distinct from fairness or morality. All those ancient feudal rules, including the allowance for houses to war within limits, are part of the code they uphold. So an enforcer patrol is likely to ignore a gang shootout in a bad zone, sanctioned violence, but they will come down like a hammer on anyone caught with proscribed tech or preaching sedition against Hellmauer. They also zealously police Imperial writ. Heresy, mutation, and forbidden tech, like AI, are top priority crimes that they will not ignore. In cases of heresy or major tech crime, they may even cede authority to the Adeptus Arbites, the Imperial Adept Presence, who will arrive to make very public, terrifying examples of the perpetrators. Picture black armored arbitrators with bolt guns storming a hive level to drag off a whispering cult or torch an illegal cogitator bank. For the average hiver, these events are like distant thunder. Most fear the local enforcer much more, as they're the daily threat. The methods of Palanite enforcers are brutally effective. They maintain checkpoints, conduct raids, and brutally quell riots or gang uprisings. Crowds are dispersed with shotgun fire and gas grenades. Leaders of protests are executed on the spot as a message. If a dome or district fully revolts, enforcers can lock it down, sealing bulkheads, cutting power, the Coin Guild and Electro Guild oblige, and then going sector by sector with flamers and assault teams to restore order. Often this means mass disappearances. Hundreds might be dragged off in chains to interrogation or labor camps, their fates unknown. Public executions are common. The enforcers know the value of fear. They might string up the corpses of captured gang champs or print broadsheets listing the names of those shot for minor infractions, all to remind everyone that Hellmauer's law is absolute. One could be killed for hoarding rations, for missing work shifts, or simply for being in the wrong place during a sweep. Yet, paradoxically, even the enforcers recognize that not all crime can or should be stamped out, only that which threatens stability. Minor vice, local squabbles, and gang-on-gang violence often get a pass as long as guild tithes are paid and the factories meet output. Enforcers will even work with elements of the Underhive when it serves their purpose. It's noted that veteran enforcers in the Underhive sometimes recruit locals, forming watchmen, auxiliaries, or hiring freelance bounty hunters to help hunt down particularly notorious outlaws. These bounty hunters are a colorful lot. Some are former gangers looking to cash in on their violent skills, others are thrill seekers or off-world mercenaries. They operate with a special writ that lets them pursue targets across house boundaries. Bounty hunters might bring in targets alive for a reward, or more often, present a severed head and a stack of identifying papers to claim the bounty. A few infamous names, like Cal Jericho, have become legends for repeatedly taking on the worst the Underhive offers and living to spend the reward. Jericho, in particular, is rumored to be Hellmauer's illegitimate son, a scandal the nobles politely ignore while hiring him to do their dirty work. The enforcers also have a darker resource, sanctioner guilds, and penal squads. When a situation is truly dire, say a full-scale uprising or a gang alliance that seized an ammo dump, Hellmaw can authorize extremes. This might mean bringing in an Adeptus Arbites strike team if there's heresy involved, or deploying Hive scum militias. Basically arming a bunch of desperate locals with stub guns and promising them a bounty to attack the troublemakers first. Cannon fodder to soften a target. In the worst case, there's always the threat of using the Hive's own systems as a weapon. Depressurizing a section, flooding it with nerve gas, or turning off the air. Recyclers until everyone suffocates. Necromunda's lords do not shy from exterminating a habitat to snuff out rebellion. They have billions more workers where those came from. Bounty hunters and hired guns. A word more on these freelancers. They are a key part of the ecosystem. Because Hellmauer's forces can't be everywhere, bounty hunters fill the gaps. The guilders also employ them frequently to protect caravans or track down thieves who stole guild property. Many bounty hunters have semi-official status. They might flash a token from the enforcers or a sigil from the Mercator Guild that grants them passage and limited authority. In the Underhive settlements, some bounty hunters even become makeshift sheriffs if the locals respect them enough. But more often, they are lone wolves or small crews drifting wherever the next big score lies. They bring a semblance of justice, but it's really justice for hire. If you can't pay their fee or post a bounty, they won't bother helping you. This underscores how law itself is a commodity on Necromunda, something to be bought and sold. While the enforcers present the facade of order, it's ultimately fear that keeps Necromunda's societal structure from imploding. Fear of the enforcers' knock at the door, fear of a bounty hunter's crosshair, fear of the unknown horror in the sump if you get exiled. This fear coexists with the other grand fear the Imperium instills, fear of the God Emperor's judgment. And that leads us to the final pillar holding up the hierarchy. The Imperial Creed, and the Ecclesiarchy's grip on the Hive's spirit, faith and fervor. The Ecclesiarchy's grip on the Hive. In a world as dark and despairing as Necromunda, religion is not just opiate, it's oxygen. The Imperial Creed permeates every level of society. The Hive population is taught from birth that the God Emperor watches over them, that their suffering has purpose, and that to die working for his glory is a sacred fate. The Ecclesiarchy, Imperial Church, maintains a strong presence on Necromunda, seeing to it that this doctrine is repeated in endless litanies from the spire to the sump. House Hellmaw, cunning as ever, fully embraces and weaponizes faith. The insignia Imperialis Hellmaw. The official crest of House Hellmaw doubles as a symbol of religious authority on Necromunda. In effect, the ruling house positions itself as the Emperor's chosen governor, a nearly divine mandate. Hellmaw is sanctioned by both the High Lords and the Ecclesiarchy, so obedience to Hellmaw becomes a matter of piety. To disobey your lord is not just treason, it's heresy against the Emperor's will. This notion seeps down to the lowest worker. Many genuinely believe the Emperor himself appointed House Hellmaw to rule. Thus, the social order is sacred. Throughout the Hive, grand cathedrals and small shrines alike provide places for the masses to seek solace, or more accurately, to be reminded that their misery is virtuous. The cardinals and preachers of Necromunda preach the value of endurance, loyalty, and hatred of the heretic and mutant. The result over centuries is a planet that has produced an unusual number of saints and martyrs, all celebrated to reinforce desired behaviors. Necromunda's faithful have a whole pantheon of saints relevant to Hive life. Imperial saints recognized by the wider Imperium, such as Saint Valdor the Blessed or Saint Mina, patron of the Order of the Bloody Rose. These exemplify grand heroism and sacrifice. People invoke them in formal mass, but they can feel distant. Great saints of Necromunda, acknowledged by the ecclesiarchy but specific to this world. For example, Martek the Unifier, said to be the first Helmar lord who unified the planet, essentially canonizing Helmar's founding father. And Encordarius the Lost Saint, a figure tied to the redemption cult, symbolizing the purging of sin. Lesser saints who are local to certain hives or regions, like a saint venerated only in Hive Primus or a particular factory district. They often started as popular heroes or miracle workers in a single hive, and their cult stayed local. Pauper saints drawn from the low-born figures like Cognus, the saint of quotas, a martyred foreman who supposedly kept to his work quota, even as a collapse killed him, now prayed to by factorum workers to meet their targets. Or Gelt, the saint of coin, perhaps a tongue-in-cheek patron of guild clerks. These saints reflect the daily grind. If you're shoveling toxic sludge, you might pray to Glurg, the saint of gunk, a half-legendary figure who drowned in the sump for our sins. Gang saints, perhaps most fascinating, are martyrs revered specifically by gang communities. These aren't officially recognized by the church. Some priests might even deem them heretical, but they exist in folklore. Names like Shanks, the saint of knives, a fabled knife man who never lost a blade fight, or Caliber, the saint of bullets, invoked when a ganger prays his ammo finds its mark. Vermin, the saint of rats, is one more, a patron for those who survive by cunning and the skin of their teeth in the underhive. That even murderous gangs seek divine blessing tells you how deep faith runs. The redemption cult within House Cawdor is an extreme but illustrative example of hive religion. This cult preaches that the world is irredeemably sinful, and only through flames and blood can humanity be purified. Redemptionists in the Underhive will burn heretics, mutants, and sometimes innocent bystanders to save their souls, all the while shouting praises to the Emperor. It's vigilante fanaticism, but House Cawdor's leadership fans these flames when useful. It keeps the populace focused on internal enemies, the mutant, the heretic, the witch, rather than questioning their harsh lives. Helmaor's regime finds it generally useful too. A populace busy accusing each other of sin is less likely to accuse the ruler of tyranny. The ecclesiarchy's formal presence likely includes a cardinal or at least high-ranking confessors assigned to Necromunda. They ensure the ministerium gets its tithes and that faith does not wane. They also anoint Helmaor's rule, literally conducting ceremonies that bless each new Helmaor heir or significant campaign. In return, Helmaor patronizes the church. It's a trade of influence. Helmaor gives the church free hand to collect donations and staff missions in the hive, and the church gives Helmaor the aura of divine approval. If a worker riots, he's not just rebelling against his boss. He's betraying the Emperor's chosen, a heavy moral burden for an imperial citizen. Even with faith blanketing society, sometimes desperation breeds heresy. Chaos cults, genus-stealer cults, unsanctioned psyker covens, these fester in the cracks of Necromunda. The corpse grinder cult, for instance, started among disillusioned corpse guild workers who began worshipping the chaos god of blood, reveling in cannibalism. Such cults are the ultimate threat to the hierarchy because they don't want to tweak the system. They want to burn it. When they surface, it often takes a joint effort of enforcers, house militia, and sometimes even space marines, the imperial fists, maintain a recruitment fortress on planet, after all, to exterminate them. But note, These extreme cases often only arise because of how brutal and hopeless life is for the underhivers. In a way, the cruelty of the system itself continuously feeds the need for redemption, or the temptation of heresy, a vicious cycle that Necromunda's masters simply accept. Religion on Necromunda thus serves as both balm and chain. The promise of the God Emperor's love and an afterlife among the saints is sometimes all that keeps a hiver going. A starving family might still light a candle and pray to Saint Mina to watch over their daughters. A mutilated factory worker might hobble to the shrine of Cognus and pray tomorrow's quota doesn't kill him. This faith keeps people enduring the unendurable. At the same time, the structured imperial creed, with its hierarchy of priests and saints, reinforces obedience. It channels the people's anger towards approved targets, mutants, heretics, and teaches them that to suffer in silence is holy. That lesson is extremely convenient for Helmar and the nobles. So long as the masses see virtue in their own oppression, they won't unite to end it. To ensure that message sticks, the ecclesiarchy sometimes sponsors grand spectacles. Perhaps a holy, hive-wide day of penitence, where everyone is expected to whip themselves. Some will literally cut off a finger as atonement, a ritual common in Necromunda. Or they parade holy relics through the hive, say the preserved hand of Martek Helmar, now a saint, touring the spire basilicas while workers are allowed a glimpse as a reward for good behavior. These displays remind everyone that the Emperor, and by extension Helmar, is watching, so behave. In sum, faith on Necromunda is a double-edged sword. It offers hope to the hopeless, but more importantly to the regime, it is the invisible leash on the populace's soul. The Emperor's name is invoked to justify all inequality. The nobles are noble because the Emperor wills it. Your guild fees are righteous tribute. Your boss beating you is correcting your sinful sloth. And if you have nothing, well, the meek shall inherit the galaxy. Just not this millennium. It's a cruel joke, but billions cling to it because often it's all they have. Privilege and pain. Life in the hive and the ties that bind. Having dissected each layer of this hierarchy, from the spire lords to the guilders, clan bosses, gangs, lawmen, and priests, let's step back and look at the whole picture. Necromunda's social order is essentially feudalism on overdrive, a human hive ecosystem carefully engineered to be self-regulating through strife. Every level oppresses the one below it, and is oppressed by the one above, in a chain that leads up to Helmar, and above him, ultimately, the Imperium and the Emperor. The genius, or horror, of it is that each group also needs the others to survive, even as they hate them. Consider the daily life of a mid-hive manufacturum worker. He wakes from his hab cubicle, cramped, overcrowded, to the klaxon of the great horologium, Necromunda's central clock that dictates all shifts, a clock sometimes called the Eye of Helmar, glaring down. He attends a morning prayer led by a House Cawdor zealot, praising the Emperor and asking for the strength to meet his output quota. Then he trudges to the factorium assembly line, belonging to House Orlok, for example, where slaved machinery and human toil combine to produce stub-gun bullets. All day he slaves under the watch of overseers. Perhaps one overseer is a burly Goliath employed by Orlok Muscle to keep the line in order. The worker knows if he slacks that Goliath's whip or fist will find him. The overseer in turn fears his factory boss, who will dock his ration or send him to fight in the pits if output drops. The factory boss answers to an Orlok House noble who fears looking bad in the quarterly report to Lord Helmar's court or losing a contract to Vansar competition. After a grueling 16-hour shift, our worker limps home. On the way, he must pass through a checkpoint where Guild of Coin deputies collect a tariff on his route. The guild must be paid for maintaining the transit rails. After all, he hands over a few hard-earned credits. A painful fee, but refusing isn't an option. The last man who tried is still hanging in a cage as a reminder. Near his hab block, he's accosted by members of the local gang, say an Escher gang controlling this zone under House Orlok's sanction. They demand a tithe for protection. He pays again, some script or a portion of the corpse starch loaf he got as wages. He knows the Escher actually do keep the peace here in a way. If not for them, some outcast scum or drunken scab worker crew might rob or kill lone folk in the alleys. At least the gang, while brutal, has rules and keeps the worst psychos out. Reaching home, he finds his teenage son talking in hushed excitement about maybe joining that gang. It's dangerous. Juve recruits often die. But the family's prospects are so limited, and the gang at least pays in loot and a sense of pride. The father can't outright forbid it. Part of him knows that might be the boy's only escape from a life of total drudgery. Meanwhile, his daughter lights a candle to St. Voltan, praying her sick younger sibling survives the ash lung coughing fit. If a child dies, the Guild of Corpse will pay a token for the body, enough maybe for the family to eat for a week, a cold calculus that families morbidly acknowledge. This worker's story is one of constant oppression, yet he is entwined in the system. He fears and begrudges the gang, the guild, the house boss. But he also depends on them. If the enforcers came and wiped out the local gang, who would protect the block from the really mad scums? If the guild collapsed, how would supplies reach them at all? If House Orlok wasn't in charge, maybe House Delac or Goliath would take over. Who's to say that'd be better? The devil, you know. Ambition flickers even in his heart. Maybe if he works hard and impresses the overseer, his child might get apprenticed as a technomat, a slightly less deadly job. Or if his son joins the gang and thrives, perhaps one day the boy could become a leader, maybe even an Orlok road captain in the far future. That could elevate the whole family out of the sump. These are the tiny aspirations that keep people going. Slim hope that through loyal service, or their children's advancement, they might grasp a sliver of comfort. For those at the top, life is a different kind of cutthroat. A noble lord in the spire may not worry about food or shelter, but he constantly fears betrayal by rivals, assassination by a subtly poisoned wine, or a fall from political grace. The guilders enjoy wealth, but know a wrong move could mean ruin or a one-way trip to the Underhive if Helmar revokes their charter. A high-ranking enforcer captain enforces law rigorously, but he must watch his own men for signs of corruption or disloyalty. The moment he looks weak, a subordinate might report him. Or worse, a gang might make a bold move on his precinct. Even Helmar, sitting unassailable above all, lives in a state of paranoid vigilance. He's held power for centuries, yet even he recently faced a planet-wide rebellion after the Great Rift's upheaval, only quashed when Guillemond's Indomitus Crusade loomed. The Imperial commander of Necromunda knows complacency is death. Thus, oppression and ambition are the twin forces in every tier. The oppressed dream of rising, the ambitious above fear falling. The guilders exploit the clans, but also dread them. A house gang could destroy a guild outpost if provoked. The clan leaders rally their kin to incessant war, but fear uniting them too much, lest they collectively realize their servitude. Gangers strive to become legends, but no any bullet could end that dream in an eye blink. Enforcers relish their authority, but step outside their fortress and they're a target in every scope and a hated symbol to every starving serf. The priest condemns sin in others, while quietly indulging in the bribes and pleasures of the flesh, because power has its perks. But if he's caught, the redemption will show no mercy, even to one of their own. And so the wheel turns. Necromunda's hierarchy persists because it is self-correcting in its cruelty. Too much ambition, a higher power crushes it. A gang that grows too bold is wiped out by enforcers. A house that oversteps is sanctioned by Helmor's agents. A noble that plots treason gets an ecclesiarchal writ of excommunication and a knife in the dark. Too much oppression leading to despair? Then a scapegoat is provided. Burn a few witches. Have the enforcers stage a public execution of a heretic ringleader to make the people think justice was done, or let the gangs blow off steam in a big shootout. If starvation gnaws, suddenly the guild announces a one-time increase in ration allowance, likely food seized from somewhere else, in honor of the Emperor's holiday, a gesture of mercy to prevent revolt. For the common folk, it's like living under a boot that occasionally lifts just enough to keep them alive, then comes stomping back. Survival is victory for most. They count themselves lucky if they die of old age, a rarity, or at least die for something like their house, their emperor, or with weapon in hand. Far more likely is to die anonymously, crushed in an industrial accident, killed by gang crossfire, consumed by some hive-born disease, or simply disappearing when your utility is done. Yet, Necromunda endures. The planet continues to churn out mountains of weapons, ammunition, manufactured goods, and fighters for the Imperium's armies. In fact, Necromunda is so productive precisely because of this brutal social order. The constant competition drives the houses to ever greater heights of productivity. No clan wants to lag behind in meeting its tithe. That would show weakness. No guild wants to be out-profited by a rival. That would invite someone taking their charter. Even the gangs compete to show their mettle. Violence and oppression are baked into the system to maximize output and prevent complacency. It's horrific from a human perspective, but from the Imperium's cold view, it's effective. In the twisted hierarchy of Necromunda, power trickles downward as cruelty, and ambition claws upward through blood. We have seen how the planet's society is a tiered cage, the spire nobles living in obscene luxury, built on the suffering of the teeming masses, the Mercator guilds squeezing profit from every basic necessity. The clan houses binding countless families in feudal loyalty and endless rivalry. The gangs enforcing the will of their betters while carving out their own scraps of glory. The Palinite enforcers and hired guns keeping the acceptable chaos from becoming true rebellion. And the Imperial Creed sanctifying it all, keeping hearts fearful yet fervent. It is a system as intricate as it is brutal. An ecology of oppression where everyone plays a part, willingly or not. On Necromunda, privilege is paid in blood, and pain is the common coin of existence. And yet, life persists in the hive. There is love, laughter, and even fleeting triumph in the shadows. A ganger finds camaraderie with her crew amid the firefights. A preacher gives solace to the damned in his congregation. A noble throws a grand ball to celebrate a successful quarter, even as workers died by the hundreds to make it so. These human moments, bright or dark, are the fuel that keeps Necromunda's heart beating in the gloom. The Hive City is a great beast that devours lives and spits out steel, and its hunger never ends. As we close this chapter, we leave our neutral narrator's perch high above the hive and steel ourselves for what comes next. The stage is set to delve deeper into the six clan houses themselves, the major players we only briefly met here. In our next episode, we'll descend into the gang barracks and factorums of House Goliath, House Escher, House Orlok, House Vansar, House Delac, and House Cawdor. We'll explore their full histories, their cultures, their strengths and sins, the sagas of the great clans who truly give Necromunda its infamous character, From the gene-forged titans of Goliath to the chem-clad warrior women of Escher, the oath-keeping Orlocks to the shadowy Deloks, the tech-savant Vansars to the flame-wreathed faithful of Cawdor. Episode 3 will unravel the lore of these legendary houses that rule the Hive's streets. So stay tuned for Episode 3, Clan Legends and Labyrinths, coming soon, where we shine a torch into the pride, power, and pathologies of Necromunda's 6 great houses. In the Underhive, there's always another layer of darkness to uncover. And we're just getting started. Prepare for more grim darkness and gritty lore in our ongoing journey through the nightmare that is Necromunda. Thank you for watching, and remember, the only difference between a lord and a scummer here is how high on the Hive they die. Emperor, protect you. You'll need it down in the depths of Hive Primus.